Welcome back to the program as we turn our attention to the fascinating world of social networks. Our guest this morning, Dr. Nicholas Christakis, argues that we don't live in groups, that we live in networks. His work has been cited in more than 2,000 media outlets in just a couple of years. He's internationally renowned for his discoveries on how social networks drive virtually every aspect of our lives. He argues that social networks influence our ideas, emotions, health, relationships, behavior, our politics, and a whole lot more. And that's what we're going to talk about this morning with my guest, Nicholas Christakis. He's a professor at Harvard University with joint appointments in the departments of healthcare policy, sociology, and medicine. In 2009, he was named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. He's the co-author of a new book getting lots of attention entitled Connected, The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. Nicholas Christakis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. How do you define in this context the idea of social networks?
Well, Jeff, most of the time when people hear social networks these days, they think, of course, of the online variety.
Right.
They think of things like Facebook and MySpace and Twitter and so forth. But what we're interested in is something that's much more fundamental, and actually that's ancient. I mean, human beings have been embedded in social networks for hundreds of thousands of years. In fact, in some of the work in our book, we talk about how we're actually genetically programmed to embed ourselves in networks, and not just the kinds of networks most people might think about, like their friends and family and coworkers, perhaps, but more elaborate, more intricate networks where we're connected not just directly to people we know, but indirectly to people that they know and the people that those other people in turn know on out endlessly into the distance. And what comes to pass is that we are therefore influenced not just by our friends and family, but also by the friends and family and neighbors and coworkers of our friends and family and neighbors and coworkers, and in fact of our friends and family and neighbor and coworkers of those people. We come to be influenced by our friends in so many ways, when it comes to our actions, when it comes to our thoughts, even when it comes to our feelings.
How has this changed over time from the periods of time where we lived in small, disconnected communities to the world now where we are more interconnected, even beyond technology, just in our ability to travel and to be in a global situation?
Well, in fact, that's an excellent question. I mean, one of the things we talk about in the book is how human beings, you know, for hundreds of thousands of years had a set of experiences that provided them opportunities to interact with limited numbers of people over limited geographic range in particular kinds of ways, you know, through talking to them, for example, or perhaps, alas, sometimes hitting them over the head, which is also something we talk about in the book, mm-hmm. the spread of violence, for example, in networks. And but of course, in the last 1,000 years, new technologies have been invented to facilitate communication, you know, starting with the printing press, church bells, you know, that send signals greater distances, eventually things like the telegraph and the telephone, and, of course, most recently, the Internet. But all of these technologies, including the Internet, are actually put in the service of a very ancient purpose. That is, people's desire to connect and their interest in being influenced by others or their ability to be influenced by others and their interest in influencing others have remained the same. So we talk a little bit about the ways in which Internet is what we say is the same but different. It's the same in the sense that it still offers opportunities for connection and influence, but it's different in a number of ways. Now, one of the ways is enormity. I mean, we evolved to interact in small groups of 150 people, let's say, and yet now online we can have thousands of Facebook friends and interact with hundreds of thousands of people, and we look at some of these huge networks in the book. It also allows for a level of specificity that was not really possible before. In the past, if you wanted to find, you know, a Norwegian ornithologist, this was not an easy thing to do, but now with a few clicks, you can find someone with any attributes you want, whether it's to have sex with them or to communicate with them in some way. I mean, it is just unbelievable the way the Internet has facilitated the search for other people or connection to other people of particular types. The Internet also has facilitated what we call communality, so it's always been the case that we've banded together to do things, but now we can, examples of this might include even simple things like a bucket brigade, but now instead of forming a linear kind of network, a bucket brigade, now many people can interact to do things like create Wikipedia, and each person contributing a little bit creates this thing of tremendous value.
But the extent to which those contributions come from individuals acting alone or searching for or participating in smaller and smaller segments of what's interesting to them, to what extent has this long tail been isolating in some ways from what has been more human connections historically?
Well, there were they've always been concerns whenever a new technology has been introduced that it would subvert like traditional ways of interacting. So even when the telephone was invented, people thought it would stop, you know, which it did, I suppose, stop people stopping by unannounced at others' homes. It would lead to opportunities for, you know, predation. You know, people would sort of lascivious men would prey on innocent women at home by calling them. It would interrupt family life. The phone would ring and there would be, you know, eavesdropping operators, you know, they'd be snooping on the phone and so forth. And, of course, very similar concerns have been expressed with respect to the Internet. So, but what I think is important to realize in these technologies is that while it's true to some extent what you said, the basic reality is that we use these technologies to do things we always did. So, for instance, someone might have, some work we've done has shown that people might have thousands of Facebook friends, but in fact, they're not really connected to all those people. They're not really their friends. And they're not actually influenced by all those people in the way we're influenced by our real friends. Some work we've done looking at Facebook has looked at, for instance, the spread of musical tastes and taste in books or even smiling and happiness online. And what we find is that in fact you cannot be influenced or are not influenced by these thousands of Facebook friends you have. You're actually only influenced by those few among those thousands who are your real friends, your face-to-face friends. And there the influence is the same as it ever was. So if you have a thousand Facebook friends, but six of them, for example, on average, as we find, are people with whom you really have kind of a relationship with, when those six do something online, it affects you. And when the other multitudes do, it does not.
How is that different from the more traditional way we have looked at taste leaders and taste setters in a society?
Well, that's actually also an excellent question. So there's been a lot of interest in exploiting these ideas by marketers and others to see, well, how can we get people to change their behaviors? Incidentally, we've done a lot of work looking at health. How can we get people to change their health behaviors, whether in real face-to-face networks or on online networks? Or how can we take advantage of these ideas to, you know, improve society, make things better? The bottom line is that it is the case that you can use networks to identify people who are more influential, but it's not the case that it's so simple that all you have to do is find the central people, because it depends. It depends on the circumstances. And in addition, another idea that's relevant here is that you don't just need, in order to have a kind of viral something to go viral on the Internet or in real life for that matter, you don't just need shepherds, but you also need sheep. In other words, you don't just need influential people, you also need influenceable people. And getting that balance right is not an easy thing to do. And in fact, when we look at networks as we have and studied when do these sort of epidemics take root, whether it's an epidemic of obesity or an epidemic of happiness, as we talk about in the book, very particular circumstances are needed for this to happen, but in general, it happens.
To what extent is it influenced by the basic nature people have of being attracted to kind of like people?
So birds of a feather flock together.
Right.
I mean, this is a fundamental property about human interaction. And pretty much wherever scientists have studied human groups, they find that similar people hang out with similar people. And the crucial thing when you see similar people hanging out together, there are at least four possible ways that could have happened. One is just it's dumb luck. Another possibility, as you just mentioned, is that they form their friendship because they resemble each other. So, for example, overweight people might hang out with overweight people, or educated people might hang out with educated people, or whatever, and it's because, or people who like, you know, a particular kind of indie rock might hang out with other people who like a particular kind of indie rock, and that's just birds of a feather flocking together. Another possibility is that the people that are hanging out together have all been exposed to the same thing. For example, maybe a bunch of people all heard the same indie rock group at a party, and they all decided that they liked this music, and that's why they, so two friends, for example, who were already friends, suddenly get exposed to this indie rock band, or two friends who were always friends suddenly get exposed to a fast food joint, and they either come to have that musical taste or gain weight simultaneously. But most interesting, or at least very interesting to us in many circumstances, is the possibility that there's a kind of contagion that takes place. So I gain weight, and that makes you gain weight, and then your friends gain weight. Or I come to like a particular indie rock band, and that makes you like the indie rock band, and then makes your friends come to like the band. And so this taste can spread. All of these happen, all four things we just discussed. But the scientific challenge is to sort of figure out when and how those things are happening.
Right.
And that's what we try to do.
And how certain ideas get into the culture, how there gets to be this meme that sometimes happens with respect to certain ideas.
Well, one of the things that's misunderstood about our work is that we're obviously a little, we're a bit of fanatical. I mean, James and I, we definitely believe that understanding networks is crucial to understanding human experience. We think that, for example, in our work on happiness, we think that the usual way people think of happiness is that it's deeply personal and that emotions are individual. But James and I think that an additional perspective is that happiness is collective, and that you can think of kind of emotional stampedes in human populations, and that whether people are happy or not may depend in part on the happiness of all these other people around them, people they don't even know. You know, if their friend's friend becomes happy, it might make them happy. So we're definitely interested in rethinking a lot of these kinds of experiences.
Let me just take that one step further. How is it different or similar from the kind of psychology we see operate in markets, be they in the stock market or in consumer markets or what have you, where you see this kind of contagion of ideas or desire?
So here we are, then, even happiness can spread. But the crucial thing to understand about how these memes take root in cultures is that, well, James and I are often misunderstood as claiming that everything can spread, even happiness, let's say. But what's crucial to understand is that not everything spreads, and not everything that spreads by the same mechanism. And most importantly, networks cannot explain necessarily the origin of phenomena. Networks just tend to magnify whatever they are seeded with. So something else has to start the epidemic. And once, in whatever it is, a meme of, taste in music or an emotion or whatever, and then the network takes over and magnifies it. So a little, a sudden noise sets off one buffalo, and then soon the whole herd is stampeding. Or something happens and creates happiness in me, and then happiness spreads for me. Or I acquire a taste, perhaps by chance, in a particular indie rock band, and then the network takes over and magnifies that. So the network doesn't start the process, but the network sustains and gives a force to the process. Now, some of these things also apply, of course, in economic environments. I mean, you can have, the notion of a stampede is mm-hmm. well known on Wall Street,
right.
And you know, as you suggested, and you can have kind of fear or greed spread through traders and cause fluctuation in markets. And in fact, in the book, we talk a little bit about bank runs. We talk about how traders can reinforce each other's ideas. When they see someone selling, everyone panics and starts selling. So these kinds of network phenomena also can help explain some of the financial problems we've had lately.
As people become more interconnected, as there is greater immersion in these social networks, what will be kind of the corresponding or geometric impact of the kind of things you're talking about?
Well, I think a lot depends on whether this hyperconnection changes the fundamental nature of interaction or not. So part of me wants to say that as human beings become more and more interconnected, it is going to offer new opportunities for human interaction and create new ways of new phenomena that arise from networks. That, for instance, Wikipedia would be a simple illustration of this. It really wasn't possible for thousands of people to altruistically collaborate to create, let's say, an accurate encyclopedia in the past. So this is something new that's possible. On the other hand, I'm a little wary of thinking that this technology will suddenly just change everything. And my favorite example of this is the following. As many of your listeners will know, the average size of a military company in the modern army is about 100, 120 people. Well, if you look at the Roman army thousands of years ago, the average size of a military company then was about 100 or 120 people. Well, we've, of course, had huge improvements in communication in these thousands of years. And yet this fundamental working group is the same size. Why is that? Why, if communication is so much better now, why don't we have military companies of 1,000 people? 10 times greater, since communication is hundreds of thousands of times more rapid than it was, you know, thousands of years ago. Well, the answer is what limits human interaction is not so much our technology, but our fundamental humanity. That is to say, our brains and the way we're used to interacting with other people. So just because we have the internet doesn't mean we're suddenly going to become able to be friends with hundreds of people. I think we're still only able to be friends with a limited number of people. But this does not mean we're not able to influence many. And in fact, as we discuss in the book, changes that you make in your life, everything from your emotional state to your desires to your actions to your body size, for example, these can affect these 6 or 10 people that you know well, which in turn affects 6 or 10 people you know they know well each, and in turn affects them out to 3 degrees of separation. So your choices and actions can influence hundreds, maybe thousands of people.
What then is the influence of these new kind of networks when you think about it in the context of political and or democratic institutions?
Well, I mean, we think that there's absolutely a sense in which some of these ideas have been exploited and can be exploited by politicians and by activist groups and others. For example, one of our favorite examples of this is that many people think, and we agree, that one of the things that the Obama campaign did successfully in the most recent election was not so much to use the technology to enhance. Well, let me conjure up this image. So imagine that, you know, you have the candidate at the top, and then there are, let's say, thousands of people that wish to vote for the candidate. The usual vision of communication is that the candidate wants to enhance his or her ability to communicate down to each of those thousands of people. But what the Obama campaign did successfully was not so much facilitate communication between Obama and his voters, but rather facilitate communication among his voters and bind them together and create a kind of positive reinforcement within the network of voters that facilitated their going to the polls, contributing money, and just basically being energized by the campaign. And so there is a way in which and incidentally, a lot of this was designed or foreseen by some of the people behind Facebook that signed up early to the Obama campaign. So there's a way in which you can exploit some basic ideas about networks, namely how to interconnect people to enhance political objectives. I'll give another example. Some work done by our colleague Brian Uzi at Northwestern looked at what kinds of production companies make successful musicals. And what he found was that if you take a group of people to put on a show, if they've all worked together before and they all are tightly interconnected, the show is a flop. And if you take a group of people together, put a group of production company together, and they've never worked together before, no one has known each other at all, the show's a flop. But if you take a group of people, some of whom have worked together before, therefore trust each other and know each other, and some of whom have never worked together before, so they bring in new ideas to the group, the show's a runaway success, not only financially, but also critically. So getting the mix right is important.
Certainly we've seen in terms of, at least on the internet, these social networks are evolutionary. I mean, there was MySpace, and then there was Facebook, and
yes,
before that there was Friendster. What do we see as the next evolution of this, and how does this impact the kind of connections that we're talking about?
I would be wary of predicting what's next on the internet. I mean, I think these online networks are here to stay. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they're going to stay. You know, I can't predict if Facebook will survive. As you said, a bunch of these others have gone by the wayside. But I think some form of interaction, online social network interactions, will persist. Now, some people think that some of these large photo sharing sites, for instance, Flickr and so forth, mm-hmm. will evolve into social networks. Or some people think that email programs will eventually acquire social network features, because if you think about it, your email program already has vast amounts of information about who you interact with,
mm-hmm.
and could, in principle, be made to automatically update your friends about new interactions. So, for example, in theory, your email program could be automated to notify all your friends, Jeff, whenever you email someone new, right? It could say, Jeff has a new friend, you know,
right.
Or and so forth. So other types of existing technologies, you know, whether it's music sharing or photo sharing sites or email programs and so forth, might evolve in the social network direction and might come to eclipse some of these sites that originated just as social network sites, but I don't know. I mean, I am willing to predict that for sure we'll continue to have social network sites online because, again, people love to interact with other people. It's just such a fundamental part of our humanity. But what form it takes, it's hard for me to predict.
And the other side of that is the degree to which the form it takes is a function of, or sometimes gets out ahead of, our biological evolutionary way to process it and deal with it.
Yes, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, we talk a little bit in the book about the finite ability, that you know, the limitations of our brains to interact with other people. In fact, we alluded to this just a moment ago when we talked about the military companies.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's restraining, you know, the growth in social networks is the fact that the human mind is only capable of tracking so many relationships. This relates to some ideas by a physical anthropologist by the name of Robin Dunbar, and many of your listeners will have heard of Dunbar's number. It's this idea that human group size is about 150, and that when groups get to be bigger than 150, they become unwieldy, because in groups less than that size, each person can know every other person, know a little bit about their intentions, are they a friend or a foe, and also can know about the relationships between those people. So, for instance, if you went to a high school that had a graduating class of less than 150, you probably not only knew everyone in that class, but you also probably knew something about the relationships between all the pairs of people in the class. But if you went to a high school that had hundreds of people in it, you know, you probably not only did not know everybody, but couldn't possibly track all the complex interactions. And Dunbar argues that this is, in fact, not only a fundamental limitation of our brains, but also played a role in human evolution. He argues that social complexity in primates is one of the things that drove our brains. The reason we're smarter, to summarize the argument, the reason we're smarter is that our brains evolved to cope with social complexity. And so I think that these new technologies, these internet technologies and the like, you know, can't change our brains. They can change the way we communicate, much the way the phone did, but in the end, we're still going to be interested in a certain amount of intimate relationships with a certain, you know, smallish group of people.
And is there inherent in that, finally, a kind of human need for privacy which evaporates in this world?
I don't know. Privacy is a kind of a weird thing because I think people have conflicting interests when it comes to stuff like that. Like every person, you know, likes a stroll on the beach by themselves or likes a room of their own or has a desire to be left alone from time to time. But equally, every person feels lonely, feels disconnected, suffers from that, wishes to have relationships with friends and others, wishes to be influential. And so I think there's an ongoing tendency. And in fact, I think some of this actually is also evolutionary. I mean, I think it's not just the case that some people are born shy and some are born, you know, gregarious. I mean, I think pretty much anyone knows this. If you look around, people vary in their interest in how many friends they would have, or they vary in their tolerance for being lonely. But actually, people even vary in the extent to which they wish to be in the middle or on the edge of a network. And so I guess what I would say is that we are complex beings. We have conflicting agendas, each of us and as a species. And there's nothing so simple as to say, oh, we must live an embedded life. Well, let me restate that. We must lead an embedded life, but we don't all lead the same kind of embedded life. And I guess I would summarize by saying the following. As we show in the book, I mean, bad things spread in networks. Murder spreads, violence spreads, germ spreads, misinformation, you know, bad information can spread, bad habits can spread, unhappiness can spread. All of those things can spread, but equally it is the case that valuable information spreads about where to find a job, for example, or about some important news. Happiness spreads. Love and affection spread. Kindness and altruism spread. If I'm kind to you, you then are kind to others, strangers to me, and you can have this kind of cascade of kindness. So What we argue in this essence in the book is that the reason we live out our lives in social networks, the reason human beings are embedded in these intricate webs, is precisely because the benefits of an embedded life outweigh the costs. All those good things that spread more than compensate us for the bad things. And this is why, in fact, we live our lives in social networks.
Dr. Nicholas Christakis, the book is Connected, The Surprising Power of Our Social Networks and How They Shape Our Lives. It's just out from Little Brown. Nick, I thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Jeff. It was a pleasure to be with you. The website is connectedthebook.com.